ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Here's one vision of our housing future. Essentially, the corporatisation and financialisation of housing, turning the rental revenues from homes into financial products that can then be bundled up and bought and sold by global investors. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. This is Future Tense. In fact, that vision is already upon us. It began in the United States during the global financial crisis, when big corporations started to eye up the single-family homes that suddenly came up for sale when their owners defaulted on their mortgage payments. And if you think the current housing crisis is straining society, well, what's to come could make it even worse.
Single-family homes are the kind of prototypical suburban home that you think of when you think of American suburbia.
Desiree Fields from the University of California, Berkeley.
Single-family homes have always been rented. I grew up in a single-family home, so they've always been a part of the rental market. However, ownership of these properties has always been incredibly fragmented. Owners would own one or two, possibly a few homes. And that changed in profound ways after the 2008 mortgage crisis. That market dislocation that resulted from the repossession of all of these foreclosed homes created a big market opportunity for large-scale investors to acquire homes and to then rent them out to meet the rental demand that emerged as a result of all of these people losing their homes. And so what we saw is this incredible consolidation of single-family rental ownership by financial actors, essentially, by private equity funds, you know, and kind of really big investors who had never before been involved in this market.
And here's how the big corporations that have moved into the US housing market make their money. And a warning, it's complicated.
Some listeners might be familiar with the phenomenon of mortgage securitization that was a big part of the 2008 crisis, in which mortgage debts were kind of bundled up into financial products that became quite profitable for many players in the financial market. What we see with single-family rental securitization is it's quite similar in many ways to the process of mortgage securitization. The owners are able to basically to package up the rental income flows and turn those into bonds that other investors can acquire a portion of. And what that means for the landlord is that they get a big infusion of capital up front. So it's essentially a way of taking out a debt that they can use to, you know, increase their leverage, right, which in turn increases their rate of return, or to acquire more properties, to, you know, build new technologies and so forth. So the securitization for the landlord is really a way of kind of taking out debt against the future value of the rental income flows. For the investors in those bonds, you know, they get a stable share of the rental income flow plus a bit of interest.
And we're talking in the United States, what, about four or so big companies that are actually undertaking this?
Yes, today there are four single-family rental landlords that collectively own almost 300,000 homes. The largest of them is Progress Residential. They own 83,000 homes. And the smallest is American Homes for Rent with 59,000 properties. There's also dozens of smaller investors who still control more than 1,000 homes. So, you know, we're talking about probably 450,000 rental homes that are controlled by investors who own anywhere from 1,000 to 80,000 properties.
Now, that might not sound like a lot in a country as large as the United States, but the investor ownership industry is growing rapidly, says Associate Professor Fields, and their modus operandi is having a significant social impact.
There's a few kind of ways that I think about the broader implications of corporate landlords in the single-family rental sector. The first is that the landscape of property ownership, it's much more multidimensional now than it has ever been in the modern era, right? So if we think back to kind of pre-2008, you had, yes, like some kind of smaller investors, but you basically had homeowners and renters and public housing residents. And so if you were someone who was looking to rent a single family home, you might be competing against other potential tenants, right? If you're looking to buy a single family home, you're most likely competing against other potential buyers. But what we have now is a market in which, you know, someone who's looking to buy a home to live in it themselves, to be an owner-occupier, is competing against a global real estate firm for that same property, right? And of course, the scales are not quite balanced in that competition. So I talk about the landscape of property ownership being multidimensional in the sense that we have these large-scale investor landlords really concentrating the ownership of rental property, both in kind of absolute terms, but also within specific markets where they own a lot of homes. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we see a whole range of digital platforms that cater to small-scale investors. And some of these are platforms that offer everyday investors like you and me the chance to invest in a fraction of a rental home. So there's a kind of scaling up and a scaling down of property ownership and a consolidation or a proliferation of landlords that's resulting from what I see as a really important mix of venture capital, private equity, algorithms, digital platforms, kind of experimenting with property. It's harder to acquire a home to live in it these days in the United States. You know, so I think that kind of poses some challenges for the, you know, the kind of prototypical American dream of home ownership and building wealth that way. And we also know that these landlords increase rents aggressively. They tend to acquire primarily in Black and Hispanic neighborhoods. There's some variations within that, but due to the racialized impacts of the 2008 crisis, those were the neighborhoods that these investors kind of got their start in. And we see that they have continued to build their portfolios in that way. And really importantly, they're incredibly aggressive about evictions. This phenomenon is pretty tough on tenants. And then I guess one other thing that I would mention, and this goes back to this idea of kind of smaller investors, corporate actors, large-scale investors who control rental homes, they also are kind of shaping the market that smaller landlords operate in, kind of help to cultivate their market strategies or their expectations about what is possible in the market. They're kind of shaping the ambiance of the local market. And in my view, I think there's been a really fundamental restructuring of the housing market through the conjoined forces of Wall Street and Silicon Valley. And I think it has made investment in real estate and kind of this particular kind of technology-mediated, financialized investment in real estate the kind of centerpiece of how our housing market works.
And while this started in the States, the corporate landlord trend is fast going international.
The role of investment companies owning rental property on a large scale is definitely a global trend. What this looks like is different depending on where we're talking about. So Spain and Ireland both were hit quite hard by the financial crisis, but the nature of the housing stock, the consequences of the crisis, and the kind of the way that policymakers intervened afterwards means that corporate landlords have largely acquired blocks of flats rather than single family homes. Sometimes they've also acquired social housing. And even in places that were not as hard hit in 2008, like Germany and Canada, those places have also seen a pretty meaningful expansion of corporate investors in the multifamily housing sector as well. And in the UK, build to rent is a kind of growing area of activity for major investors. So while the type of housing stock might look different in different places, the role of corporate and often global investors owning and operating rental properties is definitely a global one.
A glimpse into the future for some, the current reality for many others.
Shocking findings tonight that virtually zero rental properties across the country are now affordable for
rental affordability across Australia has plunged to all-time lows, with 1.3 million Australian households now in need of assistance to keep a roof over their heads.
One of the dominant themes of the housing crisis, in Australia at least, is the narrative of baby boomer greed. The accusation that an older, richer generation has stolen the housing future of the young. It's a popular media narrative, but it misses the mark, according to Cambridge University's Susan Smith.
I mean, it is easy to pitch people against people and generation against generation, but the situation with the housing system is that it's much bigger than ordinary people and ordinary families. And so the way in which what people call a housing boom has been generated really has quite less to do with ordinary people's spending patterns and a lot more to do with institutional arrangements, with decisions that governments take, and with the way that housing, which many people would regard as a basic human right, has got tangled into a huge network of international financial markets. So it's easy to blame other households, it's easy to blame generations, but actually they're just behaving in a wider context that's been set by politics and economic shifts. So I would go for the politics and the economic shifts and look at what those big corporates, large banks and politicians are doing, rather than talk about how individuals behave in a context that's really beyond their ability to manipulate.
What's also important to note is that the problems with housing affordability and accessibility are universal, and they have their making in the last few decades of neoliberal policy.
I suppose today people think of the housing crisis as a kind of perfect storm. You've got rising costs, you've got declining choice, affordability stress, uncertainty, lots of unmet housing need. And that is definitely a global problem. I mean, the UN estimates that 1.6 billion people lack adequate housing and basic services, and about 100 million people are homeless. In fact, they suggest that you need 96,000 new affordable homes every day through the 2020s to have a chance of meeting that global need, which at a time, you know, when the cost of housing is outstripping growth in incomes in most countries, is a kind of, you know, a futile act. It's just not going to be resolved. So in that sense, it's long-standing, and there's not a lot of hope there for the future if things carry on as they are doing. But if we're thinking about countries like Australia, the UK, the USA, countries where housing standards have overall risen over the years, there are some really critical things happening here where so much rests on the ideal of home ownership. And suddenly we found that this dominant tenure really, it's not delivering now what's written on the tin. You know, it's supposed to provide an asset base for people's welfare, but it's actually become mainly about racking up debts. You know, it's supposed to be safe and secure, but it's really increasingly precarious. It's supposed to spread wealth across the population, but now its share of the stock is shrinking, which is a new thing for most people. And the remaining outstanding stock, the ownership is increasingly skewed. And then you get to the point, which is that it's supposed to provide cheap housing in older age. But the proportion of under 35s who can get on that housing ladder has practically halved since the early 2000s. So we're in trouble with owner occupation. And if that were not enough, the rental market, which has always oiled the wheels of the housing system, is under massive pressure now to accommodate more people and a different demographic for the longer term. And it simply can't do it. You know, vacancy rates in Australia are less than 1%. Rents are rising and people are panicking. So that's the setting we're going into if we're looking to the future of housing.
What we know globally is that the housing crisis, as it's playing out in a lot of different contexts, is leading to a rethinking of the role of market. We can see that there are heavily financialized housing markets around the world now, and really detrimental effects that come about when that financialization of housing as a property, as a commodity, as an asset, takes precedent over homes and community foundations, and we lose sight of the role of housing as having a social value that can benefit our whole society. I'm Wendy Stone. I'm a professor of housing and social policy at Swinburne University within the Centre for Urban Transitions. This is a really opportune moment to look at how can we fund innovation? How can we get citizens more involved actively in shaping the housing of our future? Some of the innovations come around a re-governance of housing. And I think that's where we need to move to in Australia, where we really can see governments coming back into the role of regulating the distribution of housing-based opportunity for life and life chances. So regulating the extent to which not only new housing supply is developed, but also how that housing is distributed across the society and how we might use all of that money that's in the property system, in the housing system in Australia, to benefit more widely more people in this country over the long term, so that we really shift away from sort of that financialized model of housing that's ratcheting up prices and leading to increasing homelessness, to move away from thinking about housing as private property to thinking about housing as part of a national and critical infrastructure. So an essential service in the same way we might think about schools, hospitals, and other forms of really critical infrastructure that maintain a society and the fabric of a society and that enable opportunities for all people. What we're talking about are various different models of either home ownership or rental housing or mixed tenure ownership and rental housing, where a cooperative may involve a small number of dwellings that work cooperatively together to support one another, maintain dwellings, share gardens, that kind of thing. It can mean up to, you know, 50, 100, 200 housing dwellings altogether. It may look like an apartment building. It can look like freestanding homes. In Denmark, for example, it's possible to have a stake within a community housing model where if we are a part of that cooperative, we might, over time, as our needs change, need to, for example, upscale our dwelling size or downscale as children, for example, come or go. And within those models in Scandinavia, it's possible to have an ownership model in which people can move around within the actual cooperative as their life changes over time. So there are ways that we know that other countries are doing these types of things really well. And I think it's time for us to start to look at these in addition to the more traditional ownership and rental models we have in Australia.
So it is possible to definancialise parts of the housing sector, as we've heard. But changing the course we're on, given the vested interests involved, is going to be extremely difficult, says Cambridge University's Susan Smith.
I suppose if you're speculating about the far future, one possibility is that we carry on with business as usual and there's no other side of the housing crisis. We're seeing all wealth anyway concentrating into fewer and fewer hands, and housing has become part of that. So you could say that there's a kind of back to the future moment coming somewhere not too far away, where just as in the 19th century, you know, the elite own everything and ordinary people struggle to pay rent. The other option, in my view, is that our politicians could go all out to win hearts and minds to get another stream of funding into the housing system. And the only viable way to do that is through taxation. Now, people hate talking about taxation, and we know it can be an election loser, but that's because not enough work has been done to really think about the way in which a change to taxation could benefit the majority. When we say taxation, everybody thinks, oh, income tax. You know, people worry about income tax because their wages have been stagnating, and they think, well, I don't want to pay any more. I'm having enough trouble as it is. So when politicians say we're going to cut tax, they think, oh, that's absolutely marvellous. But actually, income tax is only one part of the tax equation. Taxation around housing is a complete mess. It's irrational. It's not progressive. It's piecemeal. If we could just think about the taxation of wealth alongside the taxation of income, you could raise a lot of funds for housing. You could once again have governments investing properly in housing infrastructure. You could use those funds to boost the social and not-for-profit sectors, which are going to help people with housing affordability. And you could also get yourself in a position as a government to regulate private investors so that they expect fair rather than perhaps top rents for services that meet real needs. So taxation is a huge issue, but in my view, it's not really rocket science. It's not even that radical. You know, we've had better, more progressive taxation systems before, but it is a political choice, and we've got to look to politicians and to people who influence them to get a proper debate going on this.
And that discussion, says Professor Smith, needs to include the lack of innovation that's occurred in the way mortgages and contracts are designed.
The trouble with mortgages is that they're fairly blunt instruments. I mean, they're interest rate sharing devices. And it's a little bit odd because if you set up a new business, you would expect to borrow some money and you would expect people to invest in it. But with housing, all we do is we expect to borrow some money. And that can be quite problematic if interest rates are rising and you've got a variable loan. You can't really control the costs. Whereas if mortgage contracts were a little bit more ambitious, and I know people worry about mortgage contracts, I do as well, but if you could have a bit of equity sharing in mortgage contracts, people in the United States who have modelled this have shown that, for example, you could develop a mortgage whereby nobody would ever, you know, go underwater or have negative equity, because the mortgage would adjust to interest rates, but also to house prices. So there are some interesting things that people can do with mortgage finance. It's not too late to have a closer look at that.
Let's change tack now. And in the second half of the show, I want to look at two seldom discussed aspects of the current global housing crisis that, if not addressed, will continue to impact on the fabric of society in future. The first relates to segregation. We're used to thinking about it in racial or cultural terms, but financial segregation is also a cost to society's cohesiveness, and it's on the rise. Saumrita Sarkar is with the University of Sydney, and her research interests include the science of cities, network science, and spatial inequalities.
Segregation in and of itself, we need to measure it in context of how much welfare loss is happening as a society, as a system, to say that, oh, now it's reached a really bad point. That's the policy lever that comes in, that, you know, should we then have policy solutions which basically try and counter some of these market-driven segregation phenomena that we are observing by actively providing affordable housing or actively providing, you know, transit options or actively providing an affordable mix of tenure types and housing stock types in different neighborhoods. The Australian Bureau of Statistics has a census once every 5 years, and we get a very detailed snapshot on community profiles. So in a particular neighborhood or in a particular suburb, I know exactly how many very low-income people, moderate-income people, high-income people, very high-income people, you know, how many people in each income category live in that particular neighborhood, right? So our research was looking at quantifying the proportional effects of these people in these different classes, socioeconomic classes, separated by income. And what we found was essentially poor people live with poor people, whereas neighborhoods which have very high income earners are very, very exclusive. Like, you know, they exclude people from other income classes. So as a result, what happens is that there are these super rich areas in the city that tend to get isolated over time, and they present barriers to people from other income classes entering into these areas because the housing markets get really expensive here. There's a double point there, in the sense that the richest, most affluent, most advantaged neighborhoods, not only do they exclude people from lower income groups, they are also geographically located in areas that are closest to the highest job concentrations, right? And the highest amenity concentrations. So they are closest to the central business districts where there's the highest number of jobs, right? So they're also better connected to labor markets in that sense. And they're also better connected to transit. They're better connected to amenities. So not only are the poor people or the moderate income earners living farther away from where the jobs are, they are having to travel more. They are having to pay more for that travel. And they can't essentially live close to their jobs because all those areas are extremely expensive in terms of the housing market profiles.
And as you point out there, this is a society-wide problem. This is not just a problem for those who are disadvantaged, those, say, at the lower socioeconomic end of the scale who can't afford housing and therefore have to move further away from their place of employment.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because the whole of society, if we consider skills which are very essential to the economy, so nurses and childcare workers and primary school teachers and firefighters, and there's a whole host of occupations that are very, very critical to the economy, and they're providing very, very critical services to the economy. And yet on their salaries, they can't afford decent housing in the areas that are close to their places of work.
You know, some people might say, look, I understand what you're saying, but there have always been, in cities, in large cities, there have always been pockets of wealth and pockets of poverty. What's different now? What would you say to that?
I would say, yes, there have always been pockets of wealth and pockets of difference. But if you look 50, 60 years in the past, you didn't need to be super rich to have a decent quality of life. at least here in this country. Right. But what's happening right now is that young families working two jobs with kids, if you don't inherit a house, it's getting incredibly hard for people to just have a decent place to call their own and, you know, just have a home there, essentially. So I think it's exacerbating. It's growing further and further and further apart, the difference between the haves and the have-nots.
Soumritta Sarkar from the University of Sydney. Our second area of focus is the elderly.
With her rent going up $70 a week later this year, Dawn is packing up.
I don't want to live in my car. I'm over 55. Lots of women end up homeless. I'm not going to be one of them.
She's moving in with a friend because Commonwealth rent support and her supermarket job can't keep up with rising rent.
We tend to think, quite rightly so, about the financial and mental strain that rising housing and rental prices are placing on young families and those in their 20s and 30s who fret about housing insecurity. But increasingly, those at or approaching retirement age are also being affected. Wendy Stone again, from the Swinburne University of Technology.
An unfortunate outcome of a very highly financialised housing system, in which, you know, that's what we've found ourselves now in Australia, is that where prices are really high, whether it's for rent week to week or the cost of ownership, a significant part of the population misses out. One of the really challenging aspects of this is that when people are entering later life, including sort of from that 55 years and up, sort of almost later midlife and onwards, what we've found in our research is that quite a, you know, significant number now of people who do not own their home by that retirement age are really going to be in strife with the cost of housing. Our pension schemes in Australia, the rate of the old age pension, for example, is based on the premise that people will not have ongoing housing costs post-retirement. So pensions are set quite low in the expectation that people won't have to pay a mortgage or rent. What that means for an increasing number of people is that a low pension simply cannot cover the week-to-week cost of living. There is an ongoing increase in first-time homelessness for older people in this country. And it may surprise people to hear that in the last 5 years to the census 2021, what we've also found is that there are around 750,000 older Australians in addition to those already in the private rental sector. So there's a very large and growing cohort of older people living in the private rental sector. And these are people who are also competing for very, very tightly held properties at the moment. We know that there is a whole lot of work to do to secure the private rental sector. Currently, this sector is not fit for purpose. It doesn't serve children and young people well. It doesn't serve elderly people well. And there's a lot to do to secure the housing for older people, including dedicated models of affordable and social housing to secure people in older age. Older people have particular requirements as they age. Often people can experience frailty. It's difficult to move from family or community. People really need to be taken care of in our society in a way that the currently financialised housing system simply isn't delivering on.
The importance of rethinking housing as a social resource, not just as a vehicle for profit. We heard today on Future Tense from Wendy Stone, Susan Smith, Soumritta Sarkar and Desiree Fields. And if you've only just discovered our show but you're passionate about exploring better paths to the future, why not check out our back catalogue? Simply go to the Future Tense website or trawl back through previous programs on the podcast site you're currently using. Kate Lawrence was the producer for this edition of the show. Many thanks, Kate. I'm Anthony Fennell. I'll join you again next week. Until then, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.